So there was a time when breeding animals in zoos was done fairly indiscriminately. This was in part because breeding success was very poor, there wasn't a lot of control, and there was a great demand for animals, both within the zoo field and even within a zoo. Having infant gorillas was a great draw, a great attraction. But times have changed, and populations are now more closely managed. That begs the question of how do we control populations? Well, the simplest method is to simply keep the sexes separate. It's not a 100% sure way to prevent reproduction, and I can share some stories about that, but in general, if you have your males and females separate, the chances of reproduction are fairly small. For some species in which males and females typically live separately for most or all of their lives, except for breeding, this probably isn't too much of a compromise for welfare. However, for more social species, and gorillas is the example I'll be talking about, but this applies to pretty much all of the primates and many, many of the social species, separating animals for either part or all of the time can have potential negative consequences on their welfare because you're greatly disrupting their normal social environment. Another strategy for managing populations is permanent sterilization. In the case of females, this would be tubal ligation or ovarian hysterectomy. In the case of males, this would be vasectomy or castration. Obviously, this is a pretty darn sure way to prevent reproduction, but it is irrevocable. And by permanently removing an animal from the breeding population, there's a tremendous risk of that loss of genetic variability. There's no going back when you've gone down this path. In addition, these procedures are somewhat invasive, and because some of these procedures are influencing hormones, there's the potential to influence behavior. And it's this effect of these decisions on behavior that's really what I want to focus on. So around 40 or 50 years ago, which really isn't that long, reversible contraception became available for humans. And it wasn't too long after that that some of these methods were co-opted in the zoo field. Reversible contraception, of course, has the tremendous advantage of being reversible, although there have been situations where the reversibility was not quite as great as it was hoped it would be. But these are non-invasive for the most part and fairly secure in controlling reproduction. That's not to say they're not without risks, and perhaps the biggest is that there can be influences on behavior whenever you start playing around with hormones. There's a lot of data in the human literature that chemical contraception in the form of birth control pills can influence behavior. And many of us know this. There have been quite a few studies in the human field indicating that for those women who are on oral contraception, those who experience side effects, 60% of them report effects on behavior and libido. So clearly, altering hormones is going to influence behavior. There's been a lot less work done in other species, but there has been some research done in non-human primates as well. And again, there are indications that using chemical contraception can influence behavior. There's been work done in macaques. Let's see, is it this button? Yes. Indicating that females that are on chemical contraception may be targets of greater aggression and may also be instigators of more aggression than non-contraceptive females. There's been some work in chimpanzees suggesting that contraceptive females may be less likely to exhibit sexual or estrus behaviors. And in some of the monogamous primates, like the marmosets and tamarins, there are indications that chemical contraception can affect the frequency and direction of both affiliative and aggressive behavior. So clearly, by contracepting animals, we are potentially influencing their behavior and therefore their welfare. If we want to know what the effects of chemical contraception are on animals, we need to, of course, first know what the behavior of non-contraceptive animals is like. And Sylvia Atsalis, along with some colleagues at Brookfield Zoo, and I did some work a while back looking at patterns of sexual behavior in non-contracepted gorillas. the graph isn't as complicated as it looks. Each of these bars represents a day on which sexual behavior was observed, and this is for one female in our study. And what you can see is that they are spaced fairly regularly. In fact, they're at about monthly intervals. The line, the curve, represents measures of fecal progestogens, so it's a measure of cyclicity. And typically, progesterone levels will rise after a female ovulates. What I hope you can see is that the sexual behavior peaks, generally speaking, just prior to that rise in progesterone, which tells us that there is a relationship between the hormones and behavior. Now, there has been some recent work, both in zoos and in the wild, suggesting that gorilla females may use sexual behavior at other times as well as a form of sexual interference or to exert dominance. But our results suggest that there is a pretty tight relationship between the behavior and the hormones. So what we then set out to do is to look at patterns in contraceptive females to see whether there is a shift in behavior. So the work was done at Lincoln Park Zoo, and we looked at four contraceptive gorilla females. If chemical contraception is not influencing sexual behavior, then the expectation is that you would see most of the sexual behavior concentrated around mid-cycle, around the time of ovulation. And just to take everybody back to high school biology, to remind you what the hormone patterns look like, typically during the follicular phase, estrogen gradually rises. Mid-cycle, it starts to fall, and that leads to an increase in luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone, which lead to ovulation. After that point, progesterone starts to rise. If a female conceives, progesterone stays high, and if not, it declines again. The uterine lining is sloughed off, and the whole process begins again. That's the normal pattern. In addition to looking at whether there was a shift in the timing of sexual behavior, we also asked, are females showing synchrony? That is, are they likely to be showing sexual behaviors at the same time, more than would be expected in sort of freely cycling animals? And was there any evidence that there were changes in the timing or pattern of affiliative, sexual, or agonistic behavior? So we did the work at Lincoln Park Zoo. We used the EthoTrack observation system, which I know some of you are familiar with. We collected 20-minute focal observations on each of the four females 3 to 5 times a week. We did point sampling where we recorded the activity of the female and her proximity to the silverback in the group every 2 minutes. And in addition, we did all occurrence sampling for all episodes of agonistic, affiliative, and sexual behavior. And because sexual behavior, when it occurs, often occurs for a very brief window of time, we also supplemented our data with keeper logs. The keepers would often record anytime they happened to observe estrous behavior in any of the females. So we used that as kind of a 1-0 sampling method to tell us whether a female was showing sexual behavior on any given day. So in total, we had 438 hours of data spread over 16 months. These were the subjects of our study. We had four females in two social groups at Lincoln Park Zoo. There were other females in the groups as well. We chose these four because none of them had dependent young at the time of the study. And all were on Femcon 35, which is one of the combination birth control pills. Medini and Valera were in Kwan's group, and Raleigh and Tabibu were in JoJo's group. So what did we find? So this graph illustrates the percent of days on which we observed sexual behavior for each of the four females broken down by week. If the contraception is not having an effect on the timing of sexual behavior, we would expect to see more of it mid-cycle, so around weeks 2 to 3, than any other time. However, for three of the four females, we saw significantly more sexual behavior during week 1 of the cycle than any other time. For Raleigh, weeks 1 and 4 did not differ from one another. And even for Medini, for whom there wasn't a significant pattern, the trend is in the same direction, with more sexual behavior occurring during the first week of the cycle. Now, to look at this another way, if we combine the data for all four females across all 16 months of our data and say, for each day of the cycle, starting with day 1, going to day 28, how often do we see sexual behavior, the pattern is even a little bit more clear. So here we've got day. So for, the standard pattern is to consider the first 7 days, the sort of no pill or placebo week. In a non-contraceptive female, that would be menstruation. And the predicted time of ovulation for a non-contraceptive female would be, you know, somewhere around in here. And what we found was that across the board, there was significantly more sexual behavior occurring during the first week of the cycle than any other time. And if you ask any keeper, they will probably tell you that when it's no pill week, females are really ornery, they're hard to work with, their behavior has changed. And so we definitely have support for that occurring here. So what does this all mean? Well, first of all, we do know that oral contraception is shifting the timing of estrus behavior from midweek, from mid-cycle to the beginning of the cycle. And so here again is that lovely graph showing the normal hormone pattern in a female on combination birth control pills. And ignore the breast pain line. It was the best graph I could find. You have high and fairly stable levels of estrogen and progesterone throughout the cycle until you get to that no-pill week when there's this sudden removal of all of these exogenous sources of hormones. What that means is you now have, you no longer have as tight suppression on the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, and what that means is that luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone can rise, usually not enough to cause ovulation, but enough to lead to an increase in estradiol and to trigger some of the behaviors that we would normally see mid-cycle now being shifted to that first week of the cycle. So the implications of this are several. First of all, chemical contraception can and does alter patterns of behavior. I didn't report on this, but the other thing that we found is that sexual behaviors are much less overt in contraceptive females than non-contraceptive females. The frequency of behaviors that we saw was actually very low compared to the previous research that we did on non-contraceptive females. This can alter dominance. Females were spending very little time near the silverback, and being in proximity to the silverback can be related to dominance. Second, there was very tight synchrony, of course, among the females because they were all on the same pill cycle. This is something that actually we can address fairly readily. It's a little bit less convenient for keepers to have different females on different pill calendars, but it wouldn't be that difficult to orchestrate, and it would remove some of that enforced synchrony on the group by doing that. And finally, very often we now have females that are on contraception for most of their lives. Typically in gorillas, when a female gives birth, she has the opportunity to now rise in the dominance hierarchy. And by maintaining gorillas on contraception for long periods of time, we basically remove that female's chance to rise in the dominance hierarchy. Some would argue as well that by maintaining animals on chemical contraception, we're altering their behavior in such a way that we may actually be impacting welfare because they may now not have the opportunity to reproduce, which of course is a normal and natural behavior for these animals. So I wanted to just close with some ideas about other strategies that we may want to use. And I know we have a number of people here from Europe, and please feel free to correct me if I'm misrepresenting any of this. This is the EAZA code of practice regarding breeding and population management. And I want to highlight a couple of things here. First, culling of surplus offspring is to be preferred to breeding restrictions which might affect individual or group well-being. So the recognition is that if we are preventing animals from breeding, we're really impacting their behaviors in ways that we perhaps should not be. Keeping an animal alive under conditions which do not allow it to experience an appropriate quality of life is something that we may want to avoid, and I think appropriate quality of life may include the ability to reproduce. And a recognition that selection of methods of contraception need to take into account the impact on the animal's behavior and therefore an impact on welfare. So what are we to do? Well, one strategy might be to embrace this EAZA approach. It reduces the need to manipulate breeding, but there are obviously potential ethical considerations if we were to approach things in this way. Another possibility would be to relax our policies for breeding recommendations. So rather than focusing strictly on the best genetic pairings, we may wish to step back from that a little bit and give females an opportunity to be removed from contraception and reproduce. Even though they may not be the best genetic pairings, they hopefully are not too bad as a way to kind of offer these animals the opportunity to experience what is a natural part of their behavior. But in any case, like everyone else, I would call for continued research and monitoring of the behavior of animals on various types of contraception so that we can really get a handle on the extent to which this may be influencing behavior in ways that we may not really be desiring. And with that, I just want to acknowledge keepers at Lincoln Park and the Regenstein Center for African Apes, where the research was conducted. Thank you.